explain a little bit about what a deacon is. You know, there's a lot of controversy in the church about who gets what title, actually. Kind of unfortunate. That's because we use Greek words and we make them into English titles, right? Or, for instance, the office of elder. An elder is it's a special office. It's not like deacon in some way. An elder is a particular character of a person married to a particular gift set. An elder is a teacher, is a leader, is a decision maker, and has to have special character to kind of back that up. But the word elder simply means old man. And I really wish we just kept the word old man. I wish we called them old men. Because then we would have no arguing going on about who gets to be called old man and who doesn't. A deacon is different from elder in this sense. Elders are special callers. Not everyone is called to be an elder. If anyone wants to be an elder, that's a good thing to want. The Bible tells us. But not everyone is called to be an elder. Everyone is called to be a deacon. Everyone is called to be a deacon. The word deacon is simply the word for servant. It is a Greek word meaning servant. And everyone is called to be that. As a matter of fact, Jesus was very clear and said in Mark chapter 10, you know what it's like here. You know what people out there are like. They lord it over each other. They value their self-worth based upon how many people obey them. It's not going to be that way about among you. You follow me, then you become servants. Anybody wants to be great among you? Let him be the servant of everyone. For even the Son of Man. Now, that's a phrase, a Bible phrase to us. It doesn't mean anything to us. It's Jesus. Son of Man is the person in Daniel that Daniel saw high and lifted up at the throne of God at the right hand of the Ancient of Days. Even the Son of Man did not come to be saved, but to serve and to give his life. Called to be deacons, but the people who fulfill the office of deacon are taking one step further. They're saying, yes, I am a servant to all who are in the church. You can call me servant. You can pick up the phone and dial my number, and I will answer. I am willing to be known to everyone in the church. I'm very honored that you come. Let us do that. Let us pray for you and set you aside as our servant. As I preach on this topic today, I turn again to the Beatitudes and a text that I think is actually perfect for the character of a servant. Please hear the word of the Lord. It's found in Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 16. Seeing the crowd, Jesus went up on the mountain. And when he sat down, the disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth. Blessed are the poor, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful. They shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you, persecute you, and utter all kinds of evil against you, falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. So they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hillside cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under trajectory, a trajectory that is lived by every Christian. Christianity starts like this. At some point, you are walking along your merry way, and at some point, you say, "Oh, my God, I am not what you called me to be." At some point, you are overwhelmed with how short you are. Jesus calls that being poor and stupid. You are overwhelmed by your lack. It changes you. It begins to change you. It makes you unique. You're not putting yourself forward so quickly anymore. You begin to hunger and thirst and desire more deeply than anything else in the world to be right. You want to be righteous. Jesus fills that desire for righteousness. And then we change. At that point, the trajectory of the Christian life changes. And up until that point, it starts out being very inward, very inwardly focused, overwhelmed by what we are not, mourning over what we are not, having a newfound meekness because we're not what we thought we were. And then all of a sudden, our attention swings to Jesus. And we hunger and we thirst after the righteousness that we find in Him. And that sends us back out to the world. And now, all of a sudden, we are merciful. We're pure in one thing. Find ourselves filling the role of peacemaker. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. That God's servants are filled with mercy and integrity. The first thing I want you to see is the mercy demands mercy. It's one of those problematic texts, isn't it? Bill Berman's got an interesting translation. To listen to him, point all about the Holy Cross, but I don't know, I didn't get a chance to. I was going to go with what I had. Jesus says this problematic sentence, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." Now, why is it problematic? It seems to be saying, if you're merciful, you'll receive mercy. Therefore, if you're not merciful, you won't receive mercy. Seems to say that. Jesus wouldn't say that kind of thing. He doesn't make His grace dependent upon us, except there are other texts that seem to say that. There are texts like Matthew 6, where He teaches us to pray, "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors." And in case that wasn't clear enough for us, He clarifies it by saying, "For if you forgive others their sins, God will forgive you yours. But you don't forgive others their sins. God will not forgive you your sin." And it seems like He is saying God's not going to forgive you your sin. You don't forgive other people. You won't receive mercy. It seems that way. And there are other texts, that stinking text in Matthew chapter 25, where Jesus says, "Depart from me, you workers of wickedness. I never knew you. For I was hungry and I was naked and you didn't clothe me, and I was in prison and you didn't visit me." And it seems like He's saying, "You didn't show mercy. You won't receive mercy." And Presbyterians have a way out of that. We pay our preachers bodily. Send them to seminary so they can go and they can learn that those texts don't mean that they say. I got bad news for you. That was a long time. And all I can tell you is that's exactly what that text is. You do not show mercy. You should not expect to receive mercy from the Lord. Why? Isn't that earning your salvation? Nobody says anything about what comes first. There's not a word here about what comes first. There's not a word here about earning. There's just simply a simple fact that those who have been saved in Christ, those who have been changed, those who have come to Him, will be different. You will be different. There are invisible things and there are visible things. I went to the doctor this week. She hooked me up, did an electrocardiogram. She doesn't know what my heart looks like. It has a blockage is in there or not. And she hooks me up to find out. You have to have visible things to see what's going on inside. We all assumed my heart was beating. We needed to know how it was beating. She gave me the comforting words, "You're not having a heart attack right now." Oh, well, we'll move. That's another story for another day. But there are visible signs that something invisible is taking place. And that's what Jesus is saying. He tells us over and over again in those words, we don't believe. We don't tend to judge people by their fruit. We want to judge people by their words or what they say, by their story. He says you would know them by their fruit. And he says very clearly from this text and other places in the Bible, if you are in Christ, you will be merciful. You will be forgiving. You will be moving toward alleviating people's misery. Listen, do not show mercy to yourself. And in doing that, y'all don't even know. Christianity is the only religion in the world that demands mercy. As a matter of fact, it's the only religion in the world that produces it. There's no other world religion that does that. A friend of mine, a mentor named Joe Novus, went to India years ago. He was with a friend who T.T. Chapatundra, and he was taking him through the largest ghetto in the world. Ghettos in New Delhi, literally even bigger than the ones in Calcutta where Mother Teresa was born. And as they were literally stepping over the bodies of people that they were not sure were dead or alive, Joe asked his friend, "Who is helping these people?" And his friend said, "That's why we're here. We're here to help." He said, "But who else?" "Nobody." He said, "What about the Buddhists?" He said, "Buddhists believe in karma. Hindus believe in karma. This is these people's karma. They deserve to live like this because they were bad in former lives. And if you try to help someone and keep them from experiencing their karma, karma is going to be bad at you. Something bad will happen to you if you show mercy to someone." Well, bad for them. What about the Islam? He said, "The Muslims want us dead. We're into that." He said, "Mean Christians are the only ones you're helping? That's why we're here. Why do you think I brought you here? Nobody else can help." Christianity is the only religion of the world that demands mercy. It's also the only religion of the United States that demands mercy. I'm not talking about churches here, not a denomination bashing. I'm talking about religions, you know, those big ones like capitalism, evolution, sports. None of them mean mercy. And what is the motivating force behind evolution? It's struggle to survive. If the weak don't die, we will not progress. What is the motivating spirit behind capitalism? Find someone in a weak position. Buy from them when they're weak. Sell to them for as much as you can. Struggle. Mercy will never make you rich in capitalism. A friend of mine from his church was explaining to me why these banks all of a sudden collapsed last year. He said, "You don't understand. They all think they can make more money if they put you out of business. They don't want their friends to flourish. They put each other out of business because they can." What about sports? You're playing a game. Your friend falls down. Your opponent falls down. Do you wait for them to get up and help them up? No. You can have no mercy. You drive them into the ground. You step over them on the way to the end zone. And, you know, and it's a quandary. It's a quandary for me as a Christian parent who loves sports and who wants his children to play sports. But I don't want him to learn anything on the sporting field that he applies to life because I want him to be merciful. The opposite of all the world religions, the opposite of all the American religions. It is the key to the gospel that Christians must show mercy. person begins looking, it sees the effect of sin, it has compassion, and it moves forward. The book I'm reading right now talks about the eyes of Jesus and how many miracles that Jesus began with him looking at someone. Look at the blind man. The blind man cries out, "Have mercy on me, Son of David." And Jesus stopped and looked at him. The Good Samaritan walking on his way, and he stopped and he looked at the traveler who's been beaten and left for dead. And he has compassion for him. Mercy begins to look at him. Seeing the misery that someone is in, and moving to relieve him. It moves us to relieve him of the effect. Why do y'all want to be saved? You ain't getting saved. Nobody even knows what you're doing. Why do y'all want to be saved? What is it that enables somebody to not feel the credit for you? You were willing to get into the natural place of life. What is it? I think there's only one thing that makes us want to show mercy. Takes us away from being self-obsessed and makes us want to get in with people and help them struggle. See, even when he said he wasn't going to show mercy, we called him wrong. There's a story in Hosea. Hosea has a son. And God says, "Name your son Lo-debar," which means no mercy, "for I will no longer have mercy on my people." And Israel called him God. It bothered Jonah. It really bugged Jonah. He didn't want to go to Nineveh and tell them that God was going to destroy them because he knew God wouldn't do it. They're going to be merciful. When would God ever look upon his son and say, "No mercy"? God dressed his son in our sin, and we put him on a cross, and he cried out for mercy, "Lord, Lord, why have you forsaken me?" And his own son received no mercy. Not only did God not come to his aid and take him down from the cross and nurse his wound, but God poured out his wrath upon him, giving him what we deserve. And we deserve that. I did this thing called sonship, and I talked with you on the phone. It always started with these kind of benign questions. Like, what makes you mad? I hate when people are late. It shows disrespect. It shows that their time is more important than mine. I hate when people are late. Yeah. What do you do about that? You get mad at somebody for being late. I don't know. And you start ridiculing. You don't know. Pastor of a church, a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and you don't know how to deal with your anger over someone being late? so simple it drives me crazy. What does it mean to be pure? How do you purify water? You have dirty water. How do you purify it? You add soap. You know, make pure water, make soapy water. That's different. What do? You take out everything that's not water. Pure water, the recipe for pure water is H2O. Jesus covers you. You're no longer covering yourself with your stories and with your lies and with your shadings of the truth. You let Jesus cover you, and you are what you are. And you're not afraid of anything being found out. I used to tell my students, you'll be pure of heart when you stop taking your foot off the accelerator when you see a policeman. There's just one thing. This is who I am. The one thing, I'm not trying to hide anything. I'm not afraid for you to come in the house when it's not clean. I'm not afraid for you to see me without my makeup. I'm not afraid for you to see me on my worst day. This is what I am. This is what I am. I'm one thing. That's what it means to be pure. That you're not hiding. That's the picture of integrity. The picture of integrity is not written by looking at the words that you said and did I actually say this or did I actually say that. The picture of integrity is, am I presenting the truth? Am I presenting what is really true about who I am? And it demands a change. It demands that we allow Jesus to tell us that what we are is in Him. It's perfect. And He makes this beautiful promise. He says, blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. Vision. See God's vision. It is so clear. It is so overwhelming. There's nothing else matters. C.S. Lewis writes about it in The Last Battle. He describes a man who finds himself, very surprised to find himself in heaven, and as we all live it, and he sees Aslan, the great lion. He is absolutely sure the lion's going to kill him. I went up to him anyway. Because he was so beautiful and so great that it is better to see the lion and die than to live for 1,000 years in the greatest palace that you've ever seen. That's what the promise of pure in heart. Those who are one thing, who just are what they are, who are in Christ, a sinner, saved by God. hearts filled with Christ and move toward the world. And as we move toward the world, we make peace. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Now, peacemaker, I'm going to use a little cheesy reference, but actually, it's extremely helpful. What is a peacemaker? A peacemaker is somebody who makes peace. Duh. There's two or three ways to go about it, and two of them are wrong. One are peace breakers. Peace breakers are people who feel like they make peace by telling other people what they do wrong. And if you would just stop doing things wrong, you would be at peace. So let me tell you. Let me give you an entire list of everything you do wrong. And that's the way some of us live. We feel like everybody else is doing it right, and it's my job. I've been given the prophetic office. Not Christians use that word like, you know, that's the gift of the prophet, proclamation. Non-Christians use words like, I'm just honest. Honest and rude. That's a good cover word for that. But the idea of telling other people what they do wrong will make them get right and will be at peace. The other kind of peace, non-peacemaker is a peace faker. Peace faker, that's somebody who would just rather pretend everything is fine and go through the pain of actually telling you the truth. It's easier just to say, oh, it's fine. Everything's fine. That's fine. Absolutely peace faker. I'm the kind of guy that, you know, spent 10 years married forever and always been in my life. I know better than that now. Now I know that when a couple tells me, oh, we're married for 5 years, haven't had an argument yet. Well, buckle up. Been lying to your wife for 5 years, telling her she does nothing worth the feeling. Peace faker. Pretender. Peacemaker is somebody Jesus describes it later in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, don't go and remove the speck out of your brother's eye before you remove the log out of your own. In other words, sin up close looks like a log. Sin from a distance is like a speck. See your sin as the big thing and remove it. And then go help your neighbor to remove the speck from it. You're not giving, not off the hook. He's calling us to be courageous, willing to confront, tell people what they do in the first place. A peacemaker is somebody who cares more about the relationship in general than they do about how you feel about me right now. I'm willing for you to make angry with me because this sin is in between us. I am willing for you to reject me possibly, but this sin is between us. And I care more about our relationship than I do with how you make me feel about me. That requires two things. It requires courage. We're not slaves to the relationship. We are not slaves to how you make us feel. With some friends at Presbytery yesterday, Friday, and went out to dinner with some friends. One was talking about an anniversary he had recently, and he said he got in the biggest fight he had with his wife in years of the anniversary. And he said it was interesting. The reason for the fight was God had answered his prayer. He'd been praying that he would not be enslaved to sin and flesh, particularly to sexuality as an idol. And he said, you know, normally on my anniversary, I'm going to say and do everything wrong. I'm thinking about going to bed later. And I would never have done anything, any talking to them. Y'all tuned out. Tune back in. The worst thing in the world is to be forgiven by somebody who's self-righteous. If I sin against you, do not forgive me. Please. If you are self-righteous, do not forgive me. Because what that means is you are agreeing that you are indeed better than me. That's what it means to forgive somebody from a self-righteous position. I always thought I was better than you. Now I know for sure. Yes, you sinned against me. I forgive you. I am indeed better than you. And until you believe that your sin is real, it really matters. Until you believe your sin really matters, until your sin is a log in your own eye, you're not ready to make it. It requires courage, and it requires humility. Now, what could, at one and the same time, make us absolutely courageous enough that I could live without you? What makes us courageous enough that we could do the right thing? We could be so secure in who we are that we could offend people if we had to. Say no to people if we had to. And yet, make us so humble. Make us clear that the only reason why we would say no, the only reason why we would offend is because we really love them. How could we do that? What would give us that kind of courage and that kind of humility? It would have to be something that one in the same time would show us how bad we are and yet show us how much we are